Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world.
So thanks to the tangled history of the British Isles, Catholics, I think, have a unique relationship with the British monarchy. The English, Scotch, Welsh and Irish monarchies all took their recognisable forms under the guidance of the Catholic Church. Our national myth about the just and victorious leader who will one day save us in our hour of need, King Arthur, is bound up closely with Catholic ideas. I gather that every nation has a very similar myth. The Germans have Frederick Barbarossa, which tells you a certain amount about the quality of German national myths. But moving on, it was the Tudor monarchs that allowed Protestantism to take root here and led some ferocious persecutions of Catholics. It was Stuart monarchs who tried and failed to put the brakes on that persecution and involved in their doom efforts their Catholic subjects in England, Scotland and Ireland. More recent monarchs have represented to us the Anglican establishment, aloof and inaccessible, simulating what was left of the Catholic aristocracy to adopt the character of the polite and unenthusiastic that is still discernible in the Catholic establishment today. To be fair, in the language of the 18th and 19th centuries, I get the impression that enthusiast was a synonym for fanatic, but one might think that as the meaning of that term has weakened, so has the moral fibre of many of our leaders. As Catholics, when we are asked what we think about the monarchy, we have a choice. Who rises foremost in our imaginations? Is it the pious Catholic hero, Alfred the Great? Is it the Catholic hunting Elizabeth Tudor? Is it the doomed Bonnie Prince Charlie? Or is it a figure like George II, who, it is said, felt it was against his conscience to sign the commission papers of Catholic officers in the army? We can't escape our history, but what I do hope to do in this book is to rise above it just enough to think about the monarchy from first principles. What I and the other contributors attempt is to show that the institution as we have it retains important elements of its Catholic heritage, and that the very idea of monarchy, though found in many cultures, is uniquely well adapted to a Catholic understanding of authority, and that this is true not only of the executive monarchy of the distant past, but of the constitutional monarchy of today. In order to think in this way, we have to get over the question of the personal qualities and ideas of this or that crowned head, insofar as the institutional framework itself, except insofar as the institutional framework itself shapes those qualities. Thus, elected monarchies in the 15th and 16th centuries, notably in the Holy Roman Empire and the Church, were those who did not face entrenched opposition from major groups of electors and who paid bigger bribes than their rivals. The process, therefore, tended to favour the bland and the rich. In the French Third Republic, presidents were elected by the legislature, which meant that effective presidents could be a rival to the power of the very people electing them. The French politician Clemenceau remarked that he always voted for the stupidest candidate. On the other hand, I would say that England's monarchical traditions exerted considerable pressure on Henry VIII not to interfere with the church. His desire for an annulment and for cash overcame that pressure. The same can be said, mutatis mutandis, about King Charles's desire to marry a divorced woman. Republican forms of government have given us plenty of despoilers of the church and plenty of people in illicit unions. Gerhard Schroeder was called the Lord of the Rings, thanks to his five marriages. Affectionately, no doubt. A different kind of criticism is that Queen Elizabeth II failed in her duties, perhaps even in relation to her coronation oath, when she did not veto various unjust laws, like the Abortion Act. Nor, critics add, did she publicly protest against them. This is a serious question that we should, and that we spend quite a bit of time on in the book. So I'll give a summary of our response here. The first thing to note is that under the present form of the British Constitution, she had the power to do neither of those things. A more reasonable version of the criticism, therefore, is that the Constitution places the person of the monarch in an invidious position when unjust laws are passed. If that is in an invidious position, sorry, I needed either more wine or none at all, then it is one shared by every head of state who does not have an absolute right of veto over legislation. Interestingly, I have never heard critics of the monarchy extend their reasoning to these other cases, nor have I heard many Republicans call for a dictatorship, monarchical or otherwise. In point of fact, many heads of state have more ceremonial involvement with the passage of legislation than does the British monarch, who doesn't physically sign laws or even say anything about them. Indeed, if the acquiescence of the monarch in the passing of a law that he or she has no power to impede is a problem, simply because the monarch is the symbolic apex of the Constitution, then it would seem to follow that the same problem arises for other unjust exercises of state power, not just legislation, but why not miscarriages of justice in the law courts? Should we hold heads of state responsible for these? Or should we demand that, if we are to have a head of state, he or she should have the right to overturn legal decisions? Or should we say that, because the legal system sometimes produces miscarriages of justice, no conscientious person should allow himself to become a head of state? Again, the fact that constitutional monarchs, unlike some elected presidents, are not allowed to criticise legislation or other actions of their government is something they have in common with a whole host of other officials. Government ministers bound by collective responsibility, civil servants, judges, police officers, members of the armed services, and so on. The reason in each case is the same. Their position must be insulated from party politics, or in the case of government ministers, the factional politics internal to a governing party or coalition. Are they in an invidious position? No, precisely because the rule against them speaking out is clear, widely known, and reasonable. In all of these cases, the long and the short of it is that the moral agents, in general, are not blamed for failing to do what they do not have the moral power to do. Or, to borrow Kant's pithy expression, ought implies can. In discussing this with Gavin Ashenden on his podcast, he challenged me to distinguish those cases with those of judges and others who resigned rather than serve under the Nazi government of Germany in the 1930s. Presumably, these judges had been faced before with laws they disagreed with or procedural rules, such as rules of evidence and statutes of limitation, which can, on occasion, make it impossible for a judge to give victims of crime the justice they deserve. The existence of these kinds of problems is not usually regarded as forcing a conscientious legal practitioner to leave the profession. The Nazi regime was different, however, because with the Führerprinzip Hitler explicitly rejected the rule of law as it is understood in the Western legal tradition. This principle holds, the Führerprinzip principle, that in effect that judges and others are no longer serving in a legal system at all, but simply are the servants of the arbitrary will of the leader. There is a more complicated question about how a legal or political system might become worse and worse in terms of the content of law without ceasing to observe the outward form of a proper political and legal system, and at what point good people should duck out of it. It is particularly complicated because, as a natural lawyer, I don't believe in the absolute separation between the form and content of law, which this question implies. You'll be glad to hear I'm not going to go into that. However, for practical purpose, I will simply observe that I don't think very many of those who complain about the monarchy's cooperation with the evil of abortion or the undermining of marriage thinks we have yet got to the point where Catholics can't work for the civil service, for example. And secondly, getting to that point will almost certainly involve believing Catholics being excluded from politically sensitive positions, whether we like it or not, just as Catholics could not become judges for a long time after the Reformation. There is another way of making the contrast between the Nazi regime and a merely somewhat unjust state, such as that under which we live, which is that unlike the Germans under the Nazis, we have constitutional means through which we can attempt to right these wrongs. Some of the more excitable Catholic critics of Queen Elizabeth suggest that she should have exercised a right of veto that she did not have, which, as James Bogle points out in his contributions to the book, means, if it means anything, that she should have attempted a coup to overthrow the constitution. Apparently one of the presidents of Portugal attempted a coup against his own constitution. So coups can come from above as well as below. Not only would this be an act of unjust revolution, but it is an example of the phenomenon of those losing at a game wanting to change the rules. The fact is that our inability to undo the Abortion Act is the consequence of our inability to persuade sufficient numbers of our fellow citizens of the evil of abortion. Ultimately, that is the game being played, and if we want to win, we need to raise our game. This is the wider context, of course, of the British monarchy's reserve powers to prevent laws being passed that would end democracy. The monarchy is the ultimate guarantee that laws and governments can be contested, not with pitchforks, but through peaceful constitutional means. I want to spend the rest of my time in this presentation on a quite different aspect of the debate, however. This is the question of how the monarchical form of government itself expresses Catholic principles. It does so in two ways. First, as we were able to witness last year, the coronation ceremony is one of the great survivals from Britain's Catholic past. It is particularly precious since, as a Christian coronation ceremony, it is today unique. Due to the accidents of history, neither the Protestant monarchies of the Netherlands and Scandinavia, nor the Catholic monarchies of Belgium and Spain, nor the papacy still make use of coronation ceremonies. This is a tragic and indeed scandalous situation because the coronation ceremony is such an astonishing compendium of symbolic meaning, which on the one hand gives dignity to the office and on the other reminds the observer and the monarch himself that authority comes from God and so must be exercised justly. It can't be emphasised enough that the alternative to the pomp and ceremony of the British monarchy is not some idyllic anarchist commune where everyone has the same importance as each other. There has to be a head of state and there has to be a head of government. Sword-toting soldiers in archaic uniforms on state occasions are not something unique to Britain. And they lose none of their absurdity when the man they surround is dressed like a middle manager of a chain of supermarkets. In many republics, the head of state and the head of government are rolled into one, and we see the dignity of state being appropriated for party political ends, as with the presidents of France and the United States of America. In some ways, this is preferable, however, to the might and dignity of the state being represented by a complete non-entity, which is what tends to happen with non-executive heads of state. Who actually wants the job, indeed, of shaking hands with foreign leaders and eating state banquets without the family traditions or social standing of a hereditary monarch? Whereas our king can promote his pet projects and develop his art collection while getting to know generations of statesmen from all over the world, successive non-executive presidents can do little more than change the curtains of their official residences before they are obliged to move on. To return to the coronation ceremony, its significance can be seen from a specifically Christian and indeed Catholic point of view, and also from a still wider cultural perspective. One of the articles collected in the book is by Saurabh Amari, which draws on the anthropological research to argue that the ceremony is, as Amari puts it, a ritual humiliation. In particular, the king being stripped to the waist to be anointed is an extraordinarily eloquent reminder that the royal dignity is not something he takes up at will and makes of what he pleases. This is the only part of the ceremony which is entirely hidden from the cameras. From the Catholic perspective, looking at the texts of the coronation service, it is clear that despite some irritating changes at the Reformation and more recently, we are dealing with the Catholic liturgy in the same broad tradition as the traditional Latin Mass. This aspect of the monarch is examined in two chapters of the book by Peter Day Milne, who picks out an ancient prayer at the moment of crowning, which was unfortunately rewritten in 2023. I quote, "May God crown you with a crown of glory and righteousness, that by the ministry of this our benediction, having a right faith and a manifold fruit of good works, you may obtain the crown of an everlasting kingdom by the gift of him whose kingdom endureth forever." Unquote. This text, which indeed would not look out of place in the Roman ritual, Day Milne goes on, and I quote from him, "As the archbishop performs the physical action of crowning, the outward sign, he enjoins God to crown the sovereign with graces, the inward working, saying, 'God crown you.' Thus, the archbishop's imprecation to God becomes part of the action through which God uses him as a channel of grace. It ties together the inner and outer actions in a way proper to a sacramental, and thus neatly expresses the cleric's mediating role. The prayer, one might add, also functions as a memorable commentary on the symbolism of the rite." End of Peter. The use of medieval Catholic prayers in the coronation rite after five centuries of state Protestantism is not quite so surprising in the context of the Book of Common Prayer, which uses the collects found in the Sarum Rite, usually identical with those in the traditional Roman Rite, only slightly retouched by Cranmer, as well as the same lectionary. The separation of the head of state from party politics, so far from being a problem, is actually devoutly sought after in republics with non-executive heads of state. Successful politicians are divisive because that is the nature of democratic politics. A divisive head of state is the last thing you want, so the search is on for one so colourless or long retired that not too many people will find him unacceptable. The hereditary principle does the job rather better. For the final section of this presentation, I'm going to read the final pages of the book, which deal with the monarchy as a sacred symbol. In that chapter, I discuss three examples of sacred monarchy. King Numa, the second king of Rome, as presented to us by the Roman historian Livy, the emperor Shun, the mythical ideal emperor discussed by Confucius, and the kings of ancient Judah in the Old Testament. Having discussed these, I turn to a passage of St. Thomas Aquinas. I quote him. "Therefore, let the king recognize that such is the office which he undertakes, namely, that he is to be in the kingdom what the soul is in the body and what God is in the world. If he reflect seriously upon this, a zeal for justice will be enkindled in him when he contemplates that he has been appointed to this position in place of God, to exercise judgment in his kingdom. Further, he will acquire the gentleness of clemency and mildness when he considers as his own members those individuals who are subject to his rule." So this is from his monograph, De Regimine. Here, Aquinas tells us that the king is like the soul or mind in a body. On the one hand, the authority of the king is illustrated by comparison with the control exercised by the mind over the body. On the other, the benevolence one feels for one's own body is the model for what the king should feel about his subjects. There is, however, more to it than this, because to a Christian reader, the second idea will evoke a well-known metaphor used by St. Paul to illustrate the authority of a husband over his wife and of Christ over his church, that of head and body. So here's Ephesians chapter 5. The husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. He is the saviour of his body. Therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their husbands in all things. So also ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, as also Christ doth the church, because we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. Thus the king in his kingdom is placed into the context of parallels at both the larger scale of Christ and the church and at a smaller scale of a husband and a wife. It is striking that despite the constitutional variety of his own day, Aquinas expresses such a decided preference for monarchy. He does so not only for practical reasons, the brisk efficiency of a 13th century executive monarch with his networks of personal and family loyalties, but also for the symbolic reasons deeply embedded in the Catholic worldview. The king slots into an interlocking series of ruler-ruled relationships, with God's rule over the cosmos at one end and the individual rational soul's rule over the body at the other, with Christ and the church and the husband and his family in between. In these cases, it is not executive power which is primarily at issue, but the symbolic connection between one level of rule and the next. The different spheres of the heavenly bodies, the husband, the rational soul, and the king, each represent the submission of the subordinate level to the superior level and ultimately to God. It is no matter that we may be tempted to regard what we may be tempted to regard as the real work, the executive functions of a king may be performed by his ministers, any more than it matters that the influence of the starry sphere is mediated through the other spheres before it reaches the earth. What is symbolically crucial is that at each level it is represented by a single entity, the celestial body, the husband, the mind, or the monarch, because it represents to its immediate subordinates the single God who crowns the whole cosmic hierarchy. Given this symbolic role for a head of state, it is obviously preferable to have one who is able to identify himself with the role to the greatest extent possible. A head of state who is elevated above party politics and brought up to the role as heir to a hereditary office is clearly preferable from the point of view of sacred symbolism to a constantly changing, politically divisive figure. The practical disadvantages in modern conditions of an executive hereditary monarch can, on the other hand, be avoided by making the office non-executive. Aquinas' essential insight can be seen as a highly elaborated version of a very simple idea, one common to the other historical and cultural contexts discussed earlier, that the monarch is the key to a society's relationship with what we might vaguely call the spiritual realm. This is important to my argument because I need to show that even in a Christian context, even for Aquinas, this remains true despite the role of the church in spiritual affairs. For Aquinas and other Catholic political theorists, the secular ruler is the means through which God's will is mediated to a community in relation to temporal affairs. To repeat, the temporal-spiritual distinction is not a secular religious distinction in the modern sense. There is no non-religious sphere of life in pre-modern thought. The word secular in this context means pertaining to the saeculum, the current age, as opposed to eternity, which is to say temporal things or the world. This distinction is rather between those means and goals which relate to eternal things and those which focus on temporal things. God's will is normative for each, and God is the only source of authority for either. If we want to know who mediates divine authority for a political community considered as a political community, it is the secular ruler. The kind of ruler who symbolises this best is a single lifelong ruler, wholly taken up in a role conceptualised as sacred, that is to say, a king. In John Henry Newman's famous Biglietto speech, which he delivered when he was made a cardinal in 1879, he remarked, and I quote, "It must be recollected that the religious sects which sprang up in England 3 centuries ago and which are so powerful now have ever been fiercely opposed to the union of church and state and would advocate the unchristianizing of the monarchy and all that belongs to it under the notion that such a catastrophe would make Christianity much more pure and much more powerful." End quote. Newman's focus in the speech is on what he calls liberalism, which he defines as religious indifferentism. In his works in Saint Speech, I quote, "Liberalism in religion is a doctrine that there is no positive truth in religion, but that one creed is as good as another," unquote. Liberals accordingly find intolerable the manifestation of any particular religious creed by the state, because this places one religion ahead of others. Newman connects this liberalism in its British manifestation with the political reality of religious pluralism. I quote again, "Every dozen men taken at random whom you meet in the streets has a share in political power. When you inquire into their forms of belief, perhaps they represent one or other of as many as 7 religions. How can they possibly act together in municipal or national affairs if each insists on the recognition of his own religious denomination?" Unquote. The conceptual connection between liberalism and British Protestant nonconformity is less clear. The splintering of the religious landscape after the Reformation was the result of the state's failure to suppress Protestant dissent, as well as Catholicism. But that was not a result the dissenters themselves planned or desired. The earlier ones, at least, would have preferred everyone to agree with them, and afterwards to have used state power to preserve the purity of religion, as happened in Calvin's Geneva and the Puritan communities of the American colonies. But as their thinking developed, many of them found themselves opposed to the institution of the monarchy in the context of the execution of King Charles I in 1649, and came to reject the public manifestation of religion, including the religious symbolism that continued to be associated with the monarchy after the Restoration. I cannot, within the scope of this chapter, delve too deeply into the seething cauldron of debate among 17th century Protestants, but this is explained a little more in chapter 2, where James Bogle discusses the Protestant use of the phrase soli Deo gloria, understood to mean to God alone be glory. As Bogle explains, this phrase is a mangling of 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 17, immortali invisibili soli Deo honor, honor et gloria. Gloria and honor to the immortal, invisible, one God. Nevertheless, the phrase was used to reject the giving of glory or veneration to the saints and to human leaders alike, a radical spiritual and political egalitarianism, a total rejection of the hierarchical principle set out in the last section. The kind of Protestant who wanted to advance this slogan was, for example, often opposed to the office of bishop. But the principle did not stop there, leading King James I and VI to make his famous remark, "No bishops, no king." One anecdote will suffice to illustrate the theory. The historian of Protestantism, Alec Ryrie, recounts the story of a 17th century Quaker serving girl, Elizabeth Andrews, who refused to curtsy to her employer, Lord Newport. And I quote from Ryrie, "He teasingly offered her £20 if she would. She replied that even if he offered her his entire estate, I durst not do it, for all honour belongeth to God." This idea is part of Protestantism's radical disintermediation, the stripping out of those persons or institutions which stand in some sense between God and the individual believer. The individual is to discern God's will directly, from the Bible or from private inspiration, without the guidance of the church or an authoritative interpreter, a bishop or pope, as enjoying teaching authority. The individual is to pray to God directly, without mediation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the saints or the angels, or the public prayer of the church. The individual is saved, if he is saved, directly by God, without the need for the human institution of the church or the sacramental system. This is not incompatible with the use of a rite of baptism, for example, as long as it is understood as only a sign, not something either necessary for salvation or really efficacious, causing a genuine regeneration, a rebirth, a washing away of original sin. Then again, traditions of interpretation, theologically authoritative individuals, and institutional structures inevitably arise, even among radical Protestants. But these are always ad hoc and fragile, and this kind of Protestantism is highly fissiparous. I'm reminded of what happens on social media when Protestants reject the virgin birth, and are reminded by Catholics that this is a doctrine that was accepted by Luther and Calvin and, you know, various other people, and they don't care. They don't care. It doesn't mean anything to them. They just don't have that conception of authority or tradition, or it's an argument that doesn't work. The ability of Protestants to accept all kinds of formal arrangements, including even bishops on occasion, without believing in them in the traditional way, is a confusing aspect of the situation. A 16th century moderate Puritan like Edmund Grindal, who spent all his time sitting in his bishop's palace because Elizabeth didn't like him, who rejected the sacrament of holy orders, could assume the title of Archbishop of Canterbury as an administrative convenience, or perhaps as a decorative feature of Anglicanism that reassured religious conservatives, while not thinking there was anything intrinsically problematic about religious communities that which did not have bishops. Indeed, this has been the position of most of his successors down to the present day. This contrasts very much with Aquinas' hierarchical vision of the world. The hierarchy of the celestial spheres, of the angelic choirs, of the church, of the family, or of temporal rulers, is one in which each link in the chain is causally efficacious. It is a real moving part, a link in the causal chain. In other kinds of hierarchy, a leapfrogging of intermediate steps may be possible and occasionally necessary. A field marshal can command a private soldier, for example. But this does not make the other ranks redundant, and is not in any sense better for the command to come directly from the top than going through the intermediate ranks in the normal way. The archaic scientific paradigm Aquinas worked with should not blind us to the significance of the contrast between his view and the radical Protestant one. Archbishop Grindal viewed the succession of bishops, as I have just noted, as spiritually non-functional, with the real work being done directly between God and the individual. The scientific parallel will be to see in the succession of falling dominoes, one domino as not having any real causal power over the next domino, but each being toppled over directly by God. This view, called occasionalism, is the application to science of the principle of what I call disintermediation. The only real causation is that of God, as opposed to what Aquinas called secondary causation. The adoption of Aristotelian science by Catholic thinkers in the 13th century was crucial for the later scientific revolution because, despite its flaws, it directed investigators' attention to the individuals at each point in the chain of causes. Unlike Platonism, which attributed causal efficacy to abstract entities in the realm of forms, Aristotle insisted that causal powers were to be found in the individual. As he said, man begets man, universal man does nothing. If you want to know how sea turtles reproduce, Aristotle tells us, don't just engage in the intellectual contemplation of the concept of sea turtle, like the Platonists, nor should you attribute everything directly to God, like the radical Protestants. You should go and examine some sea turtles. This scientific instinct was a good fit for Catholicism because, as Catholic theologians had been insisting for many centuries, the institutional church, the sacraments, and the individual believer are not just play acting. They have real causal significance in the economy of salvation, something which is true alongside the reality that it is all ultimately radically dependent upon God. The parallel holds true in all the areas of life in which there are intermediaries between the individual and God. Part of the motivation for Protestant disintermediation is to focus all attention upon God. Another part is to turn attention away from created things. God alone deserves glory because, as James Bogle notes, on this view, the whole of creation is radically corrupted by sin. Catholics, too, believe that sin has affected the world in a profound way, but not in such a way that, for example, it is inappropriate to use art to praise God or reason to investigate him. These created things can be purified, even redeemed. For the Protestant radical, this is impossible. So the purity of religion consists in removing created things from it as much as possible. This explains Newman's description of the Protestant sects that they think a de-Christianized monarchy would make Christianity much more pure and much more powerful. They might concede that the monarchy or something like it is politically necessary, but they would much rather had no place in the public manifestation of religion. In a similar way, they would rather fine music or subtle intellectual endeavour or complex hierarchy, if they must exist, had no place in the evangelisation. It is inappropriate to place any of these things between the individual believer and the Almighty, because as created things, they are affected by sin and associated with human pride. Of course, created things cannot be entirely evicted from religious affairs, but this general tendency of thought leads to radical simplification in music, art, and architecture, and to anti-intellectualism and egalitarianism. The hope, as Newman expressed it, is that a purified religion will be much more powerful because the extraneous elements are holding it back. The force of this way of thinking is well expressed by the influential modern theologian Karl Barth, who says not or not only that philosophical arguments for the existence of God don't work or don't produce genuine faith or get in the way of a trusting acceptance of God's self-revelation. Rather, what he says is that a philosophical argument for the existence of God would, if accepted, lead the philosopher to believe not in God at all, but in a false God, an idol of his own making. Human reason, as an intermediary between the individual and God, will actually divert the individual away from God towards something else entirely, something positively evil. The long transition from the world of the 13th century to the present was characterized by the rise of individualism. This may have been driven above all by economic and technological developments, but the process was defended and justified and opposition to it brushed aside by reference to an ideology. Notably, the claim that those things which impede individualism represent unreasonable restrictions on liberty and are an affront to the dignity of the individual. This ideology, as we experience it today, is the descendant of the claims of radical Protestants of now 4 and 5 centuries ago. Similarly, while only a small remnant of hardline Protestants today still believe in the radical depravity of the created world, in aesthetic judgments, the association of purity with simplicity is still culturally powerful. The cultural history of England and of Anglicanism has been characterized by a prolonged struggle between the tendency to simplify, cut down, individualize, and equalize, and attempts to retain or recover complexity, decoration, and hierarchy, often with reference either to the Catholic past or to Catholic influences from abroad. The British monarchy is the outstanding example of something preserved from the Catholic past. It is not just that it stands in politics and law between the individual and the God from whom all power comes. Any head of state will do this on Catholic principles. But, that this mediation is not something to be played down and be embarrassed about, but to celebrate and venerate. This institution is an affront to the radical Protestant instinct, which would say that if a leader is absolutely necessary, he should be distinguished as little as possible from everyone else because he represents a danger of venerating something other than God and something created and therefore evil. On the contrary, the Catholic instinct is that the means by which, in the circumstances of our own history and traditions, God's authority is mediated to us is worthy of veneration precisely because God is worthy of veneration. The angels and saints, even our Blessed Lady herself, are nothing without the grace of God. Since God's grace has made them something, the Catholic principle says, let us recognize this fact by according them the respect which possessing this grace makes them deserve. The Pope, the bishops, and the clergy in general are nothing without God's grace and may not even be worthy individuals, but their office gives them genuine dignity because it was established by God to make possible our spiritual government and the sacraments. The king, too, whatever his personal qualities, warrants our respect because the office he holds is a glorious one. God has made it so by giving him the position in accordance with law and custom. As noted, the idea that the institution of the monarchy is a fitting symbol of the community's interface with the spiritual realm is not simply a Catholic one, but one which is common to a great variety of cultures and traditions. It is Protestantism and the individualism and egalitarianism it has spawned, which is the outlier. A monarch, particularly in the British tradition, is not simply just another kind of head of state. To repeat what I noted earlier, because this is a sacred office, it is one which the office holder must, as much as possible, be identified with, and a single hereditary lifelong appointment reflects the source of this authority better than any other. The disappearance of the monarchy would represent the triumph of a secularised version of the Protestant revolt against the Catholic tradition, which itself reflects the common patronage of all traditional societies. Whereas the Protestant wants to remove the monarchy to see God more clearly, his modern descendant has come to see the flattening and erasing of all hierarchy and complexity as an end in itself. The glory goes not to man and not to God, but is simply expunged from the world. The modern ideal is manifested all around us. Architecture which eschews beauty, music too sophisticated for harmony, food lacking taste, relationships without commitment. The supposed utilitarian advantages of unencumbered and aerodynamic modern institutions are in practice overwhelmed by the loss of a sense of continuity, stability, familiarity, and connection with the spiritual, all things, which makes for a sense of social solidarity. Solidarity, the sense of common interest with other members of the community, is perhaps the key concept that explains the connection between our political and cultural traditions and matters of practical politics, such as family breakdown and what happens in a civic emergency, whether people rally round to help each other or loot the nearest shops. A recognisable hierarchy with a monarch connecting the community to the divine as a comprehensible symbolic system unifying the state is of no small account in underpinning solidarity. Not to be neglected either, however, is the vocation this system gives to the monarch himself, to be a symbol not only of national unity, but of the right ordering of things. As Confucius expresses it, the monarch is to fold his hands in a respectful fashion and face south.
This podcast was brought to you by the Latin Mass Society. We hope you enjoyed it and would appreciate your rating the podcast on the platform you are using. If you would like to find out more, do visit our website and consider joining us or giving us a donation.